Hello, I'm Peter Donat. Joseph Campbell's Transformations of Myth Through Time is a series of programs presenting Campbell's unique vision of the mythological evolution of the human species. The programs are drawn from a number of lectures Campbell delivered across the country in the years 1982 through 1984. In a conventional sense, Joseph Campbell speaks to us as a scholar, offering insights into our historical world. Quite unconventionally, Campbell penetrates this outer world of scholarship to reveal the inner world of a spiritual life. He is speaking about the soul of our ancestors, the soul of every man, of every woman. The first program in the series begins literally at the beginning, the dawn of man, with the one experience shared by all of humanity, our birth from our mother's body.
The material of myth is the material of our life, the material of our body, and the material of our environment. And a living, vital mythology deals with these in terms that are appropriate to the nature knowledge of the time. The imagery of the human body is really the founding imagery of myth. This, I would say, is the basic image of mythology. The first experience of anybody is the mother's body. And what Levi Bruhl called participation mystique, this mystic participation between the mother and child and the child and the mother, is the final happy land. The earth and the whole universe as our mother carries this experience into the larger sphere of adult experience. And when one can feel oneself in relation to the universe in the same complete and natural way as that of the child with the mother, one is in complete harmony and tune with the universe. And I would say getting into harmony and tune with the universe and staying there is the principal function of mythology. The problem when societies develop out of the earlier primeval condition is to keep the individual in this participation mystique with the society. Now, looking around, you see how little chance we have, particularly if you live, as I do, in New York. Also, in relation to this, we have the problem of the woman and the man in relation to mythological experience. In spite of what our new unisex movement is stating, the differences are radical from the very beginning to the end. And this is not a culturally conditioned situation. Here is an earlier little Madonna. This is one of Jane Goodall's chimpanzee friends. Now, one of the problems in the human development is that of the long infancy. The child, until 15 or so, is in a situation of dependency on the parents. And this attitude of dependency, the attitude of submission to authority, expecting approval, fearing discipline, this is the prime condition of the psyche. And it is drilled in. Also, the particular mores, the particular notions of good and evil and roles to play of the society are imprinted. What is born is a blank. It's a little biological creature living spontaneously out of its nature. But immediately it's born, the society begins putting its imprinting upon it, in the mother body and the whole attitude of the mother. You can have a gentle, loving mother, or you can have one who is resentful of the birth at all. And then this conditions a whole psychological out-of-adjustment situation. I was surprised to hear from Jane Goodall that the young chimpanzee also has a long period of dependency on the mother. And one of the psychological problems of the chimp is the same as that which the human being faces. Namely, after weaning and disengagement, to become actually psychologically disengaged from the mother. Now, until very, very recently, the condition of the female in the human society has been that of service to the coming and maintenance of life, of human life. That's her whole function. The woman is in the role of the center and continuator of nature. The man is not. He has a very short and unimportant, finally, relationship to this whole problem. He has another set of concerns. Here go Jane Goodall's males out to work. Now, she tells that they control an area of some 30 miles circumference, and they know where the bananas are. And when the bananas are failing in this area, they know where to go for more. They also are defenders. They defend against invasions by other little tribes and so forth. And just in the primary way, the function of the male in this society is to prepare and maintain a field within which the female can bring forth the future. And these are two quite different roles. And the bodies are made for them as well. Now, the male is not engaged like the woman in a constant charge of children and so forth. He has a lot of free time. He knows where the bananas are. It isn't time to go there now. Nobody's bothering us. So what do we do? This is it. In men's clubs, delousing each other. Now, this whole thing, which very sadly, I would say today, is being invaded and destroyed, the idea of the men's club where no women are allowed is a very important social institution. One of the saddest indications today of what's happening is in New York City, in the Princeton Club, a little panel on the floor, entry into the bar, that says, "Here we get away from the women." And you go in there today, and all these women alumni of Princeton are in the bar. So this is a long-standing institution. The men's hunting team, together, whatever. Now, here they are defending the community. It was something to hear this beautiful woman, Jane Goodall, go across the stage, bellowing and howling to let us know what this sounded like, and she could imitate it to perfection. Now, this is the male job, and here we are in New Guinea. These are hill tribes people. Now, the interesting thing about this is that this is a ceremonial battle, and serious. In this area, in Highland New Guinea, there's plenty of food. There's no need for one tribe to invade another to get their property. What are the men going to do? They're sitting around, nothing to do, so they invent a war. This is a war game, and the spears are serious. So when one is killed, the battle ends, and then we have a period of waiting for another surprise attack. So this gives the men something to do all the time. They're on the guard against the other one, launching the return attack. They're preparing for it and so forth. And the male has to have something serious to do, that's all. Now, here we go back to the animal world again. There are a couple of stallions fighting over a mare. There she stands, and she doesn't care who wins. Somebody's going to take her on. This is the invasion of a territory. This is a great lizard, and this little fellow is coming to claim the territory of this other fellow, and so they're in conflict there. Now, the male body is built for this sort of thing. And it's a fact. In the human body, every muscle has an impulse to action. And one is not fully alive unless one is in action. And so we have the invention always in societies of games. Games of strength. Games of cleverness. Games of winning. Now, in the male community, what is important is the ranking, the pecking order, what Jane Goodall called alpha male. Who is alpha male? Who's top male? This, which we see here, is a charging display. This fellow's coming down the line, pulling down branches and so forth, and anyone who wants to claim top male position has to challenge him in this action. And the winner is top male. She describes one little fellow who was anything but a top male, who found that by kicking oil cans around, he could make quite an impression. And for a couple of days until everyone else caught on, he was top male. Now, she describes a very interesting episode, which strikes me, and I bring it forward simply as a little suggestion. She was seated on a hill slope, observing through glasses a number of her chimpanzee friends over on the opposite slope of the valley. There were half a dozen males and females to the same number, about, and a few of the little ones. And it was pouring rain. We're in the tropics. It's pouring rain and a rumbling of thunder. And then suddenly there was a prodigious thunderclap and the males went bananas. They started charging displays one after another, just down the line. Now, when I heard that, I recalled that Giambattista de Vico, the 17th century philosopher, had suggested that the first notion of the Godhead arose out of experiencing the voice of the thunder. The voice in the thunder is the first suggestion of a power greater than that of the human system. Now, the male chimpanzee is almost twice as heavy as the female. There's no question about physical supremacy here. And this goes largely for the male-female in the human sphere as well. This power of the male and the female submission to it, the female is physically vulnerable. Also, she is booty. And one of the problems of the male is to protect the females of the community from abduction. And so this is a long-standing situation, and the breeding of the race favors these two opposed physical organizations. And so the myths have to deal with this. And the male body and the female body have their symbolic values throughout the system. Now, as for biological spontaneity, the young female chimp takes her younger brother or sister as a doll and is imitating mother and playing with the child, and the mother has to be careful that nothing happens because it's a bit of a clumsy operation. The males don't do this. The young male starts pushing young females around. Then he starts pushing older females around. And then when he gets to be really big and strong, he enters the men's group and finds his place in the pecking series. Two entirely different spontaneities. Two very different natures. Now the next thing. It used to be thought that the thing that distinguished man from the beast was his tool making. Homo habilis, man the tool maker. This is a female chimp who has made a sheaf of straws like this, has pulled the leaves off and prepared a system of tools for herself. What she is doing is poking this reed down a termite hole. And the termites down there grab it. And then she draws it out and licks them off. And after she's done this for a half hour or so, this stick begins to get soft. So she throws it away, picks up the next one she's prepared, and goes on. We'll go on for 2 or 3 hours this way, like some woman eating candy and reading a French novel. But she's actually got tools here. Now we come to an artist's representation of an Australopithecine. This is one of the, well, perhaps the earliest grade of hominid that has yet been identified. This is in South and East Africa. This type of creature is now being pushed back to something like 4 or 5 million years ago. He has picked up a tool and is running, but the important thing are the legs. Apparently, the first essential development of the hominid, distinguishing him from the arboreal ape, is this kind of running leg. That released the hands. The way in which the apes walk is with this knuckle use of the front legs or arms. Compare these legs with the beautiful legs of Jane Goodall here. And this is the first thing. It used to be thought the brain enlargement was the main distinction. Not so anymore. It's the legs. This leaves the hands free for manipulation, and then the brain increases. Here is a hand from southern Ethiopia from 4.5 million years ago. There was never knuckle walking on those bones. There's a human hand already, 4.5 million, four and a half million years ago. Now, this first type of human being, when we get above the Australopithecine, which has the brain capacity simply of an ape, is the Homo habilis, as he's now called, with a brain capacity a little larger than that of a male gorilla, something like 980 or 60, or between 60 and 80 cubic centimeters. Beyond that, then, we come to the second grade of man, known now as Homo erectus, the first example of which was Pithecanthropus from Java, called Java Man. The brain capacity here is up around and slightly over 1,000 cubic centimeters. And here we have a tool from this date, about 500,000 BC in this case. It's a practical tool. If apes could handle stone and break it, the tool would be a practical tool of this kind. But I want to show you something that, for me, represents the emergence of a human type of consciousness, the birth, you might say, of the spiritual life, such as no animal would ever have prepared, and it's this tool here. This is from 500,000 BC and was found on the banks of the River Thames. It's larger than what would be useful. This is about 6 or 8 inches long. But what Robertson Jeffers, the California poet, calls divinely superfluous beauty is here. Now, there are two types of human being. There's the animal human being, who's practical, and there's the human human being, who is susceptible to the allure of beauty, which is divinely superfluous. This is the distinction. It's the first little germ of a spiritual concern and need of which the animals know nothing. Since that is larger than what would be practical, the suggestion is that it must have been used in some sort of ritual context. So there is a slight suggestion here of the probability, if not the possibility, if not the probability, of some sort of ritual action, probably associated with the meat or food that is to be eaten. We come now to Homo sapiens. This is the first order of Homo sapiens, Homo sapiens neanderthalensis, Neanderthal man. He used to be the one that was called the ape man, but we find that his brain capacity in some cases is over 1,600 cubic centimeters. And the brain capacity average today is less than 1,600 cubic centimeters. So we've got to pay our respect to this chap. He was a tremendously powerful figure that emerged and took the land just south of the great glaciers of the Virum glaciation, the last glaciation, appearing somewhere around 200,000 BC and surviving until about 40,000 BC. That's a long, long season. And I want to stress him. This is Homo sapiens. The brain has come to a certain size and there is a transformation of consciousness, and it's at this period that the first infallible signs of mythological thinking appear. And they appear in two aspects. And the first is this of burials. What we see in this is a burial from about 60,000 BC from Mount Carmel in what's now Palestine. And this form here is the jawbone of a boar. In other words, a sacrificial offering has been associated with the burial. The burial is in the crouch position of the fetus, returned to the womb. This is the first experience of mystery beyond that of the magic of divine superfluous beauty. This character was our friend, walking around, warm, talking. He lies down, something departs, it's cold, stiff, and begins then to decay. What has left him? The notion that what has left is still alive is what we experience here. Burial with grave gear. It's in this period of Neanderthal man that the first burials appear. Some remarkable burials have recently been found in northern Iran and Iraq, in that area there, of Neanderthal men from about 60,000 BC. And there's one in a site called Shanidar, S-H-A-N-I-D-A-R, where a male, powerful male, was buried with flowers on top of him. The pollens remain and have been identified, most of them of medicinal plants. It may have been a shaman of some kind. But beyond that, beneath him were the bones of two women and a child. Do we have a sati burial here already? We don't know. Date about 60,000 BC. So the human spirit lives on beyond the wall of time that we know, and one relates to it. Here is one of Jane Goodall's apes, whose tiny little thing here has died of the polio. There was a polio plague that struck the little community. And this poor woman had no idea what had happened here, and just walked around for days holding this little thing in its hand until it began to stink. Then she takes it over her shoulder, walks off into the forest, and comes back without it. Something has happened. There's no conscious relationship to it. There's no way to handle it, turn it into something significant. That is the opposite to the human experience system. Now we go back to Neanderthal times. I said there were two signs of the beginning of mythological experience and thinking. First was human burial. The second is worship of cave bear skulls. In the high Alps of Switzerland and Silesia, there have been found half a dozen small cave chapels in which there are cave bear skull caches, hiding places where cave bear skulls have been kept. Some of them have rings of stone around them. Other ones like this one, has the long bone of the bear in the bear's mouth as though the bear were eating its own flesh. Others have the long bones poked through the eyes, fear of the evil eye, apparently. But just as the human being who has died is still there, so is the animal who has been killed still there, and we have to take care of revenge, malice, and so forth. Now, the typical system of belief among hunting people who are killing and eating animals all the time and do not feel, as we do, that the animal is a lower form of life. The animal is an equivalent form in another aspect and is revered, is respected, and yet killed. The basic mythic theme of hunting cultures is the animal is a willing sacrifice, comes willingly to be killed. You can find this in the myths all over the place. But comes with the understanding that will be killed with gratitude, that a ceremonial will be conducted to return its life to the mother source for rebirth, so that it will come again next year. And then there is the idea of a specific animal that is the, you might say, alpha animal, to whom the prayers and worship are addressed that are to concern the entire animal community. As though there were a covenant between the animal and the human communities, honoring the mystery of nature, which is life lives by killing. No other way. And it is the one life in two manifestations that is living this way, by killing and eating itself. And so perhaps already in this figure of the cave bear skull consuming its own flesh, we have that image of what life is. This, I think, is the prime image. Now, we don't kill the animals we eat. We have butchers who do that. And the food comes all nicely packed, particularly in the shopping centers. And you see people throwing this one around that, oh, I'll take this and put it. It's a different attitude. These people thank the animal for having given itself. We thank our notion of divinity for having given us this meal. It's a totally different psychology, a totally different mythology. The prime one is this, of life in its various manifestations consuming itself. Now in Japan, in northern Japan, in Hokkaido, there remain a race of people that are Caucasoid, not Mongoloid, and these are known as the Ainu, A-I-N-U. And their principal cult is a bear cult. This is today. This is 40 to 60,000 years later than the forms that I've been showing you. The conservatism of primitive man is basic. To change a form, even of a tool, is to lose its power. And so you have here a cult from 60,000 BC still in northern Japan among the Ainu people. There is a sanctuary of black bear skulls of the Ainu, the counterpart of the caves that I showed you from 60,000 years ago. Now this idea, the animal master is basic, the covenant of the animals, the notion of the physical as being secondary to the spiritual life energy, a ritual of thanks and of returning the energy to its source for another visit.